ComC is your home to buy, sell, and flip all the hottest trading cards. Are you tired of spending hours listing cards for sale? Well, ComC Marketplace is the easiest place to sell cards online. ComC will identify, scan, list, store, insure, package, and ship. Just send them your cards, and they take care of the rest. All you have to do is set the price. Visit ComC.com today to start selling your cards. You're listening to the Wax Pack Hero Sports Card Minute, a podcast where we discuss both the hobby and business sides of collecting. I'm your host, Mike Summer, and I want to help you buy, sell, and trade your way into a collection you'll love. Welcome back to part two of our conversation with Adam Gelman. Last time we talked about his collection. This time we're going to talk about his content creation. He was one of the first people out there that had a website and blog devoted to sports cards and what was going on behind the scenes with some of these sports card companies and the people involved in some of these stories. We're going to talk a little bit about the origin of his website, how that has transitioned into the video content that he creates today, what it's like having a pretty unique personality or a pretty notable personality in the hobby that rubs some people the wrong way and how he navigates that. I really enjoyed having the conversation. I hope you enjoy this part as well. Let's spend a few minutes talking about content, right? Because that's one of the other things that you're known as, not just your Becky Lynch collection, but also the content that you create. Why did you start the original website?
So back in 2007 and 2008, I mean, I really despised hobby content back then. It was so rainbows and lollipops. And, you know, if you go back in the Wayback Machine or wherever on the internet to see some of the sites that were up on the internet back then, it was very focused on granularity within the hobby. And we're talking about either this is a really cool feature of this really specific set in baseball, or it was very much Beckett, which is like, oh, this is all super awesome. Nothing is wrong, blah, 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 blah. And I hated it. I was like, this industry is incestuous with people working in for the same companies. You know, they just transfer back and forth, run by criminals. Like the hobby back then was had a seedy underbelly that no one talked about, period, end of story. Because Beckett had advertisers that they had to make sure, the card companies depended on their values. Like, all of these things were very focused in delivering a specific message of hobby positivity, which even to this day, I still revolt against. My site was created to expose some of the really challenging aspects of being a collector in that era. And so you're talking about altering cards, fake signatures, fake autographs that people have in their hanging up on their wall because they thought some paper COA from some rando in Pennsylvania made this autograph legit, right? And so I started covering stuff like that. And like, this was an era where cards were on the major downswing. Every year there was an article in the New York Times, card shows are dead, like card shops are closing. Like, it was really, really tough. And so to have people come in and say, well, we need to be positive and continually reinforce that these awful products are really going to do us any favors, I said, forget that in so many words. And I said, I'm going to cover everything that's my personal opinion. I'm going to cover all of the negative scams and stuff that were out there, people faking autographs and switching patches out, making cards trying to be more valuable, because cards at the time just didn't have the momentum that they do right now. So I started building my website, and I'm an English major. I went to college and majored in English. I love to write. So back then, you know, YouTube content really wasn't a thing. But I did a ton of writing on my website, and it was cathartic, and it was an incredible experience. I've made a ton of friends through my site. And, you know, it's only now that some of those people, because there's two blogs that have really survived the times. One of them is mine, and one of them is like Chris Harris and Stale Gum. And like, you know, you look back to like the big sites of the day, Wax Heaven, he's back now. But I mean, for a while he was gone, like he just left. and like the influence of the bloggers back then in this, we were big fish in small ponds, like really small ponds, puddles even. Now you have these massive influencers like Jeff Wilson, who I can't stand, and other people who I can't stand, because they present a lot of the same things and same mentalities that Beckett did back in the day when they were overcompensating for the negative aspects of the hobby. So that's where my website was born. And it's just, I just love writing. I don't post as much anymore. Like I maybe do one post every couple of months because I've switched to YouTube content, but I've also, you know, just realized that Twitter and social media is just so much more fun when it's in bite-sized chunks. So I'm on Twitter constantly. And it sucks that Elon Musk has come in and done what he did to that site, because I live on Twitter. I love Twitter. I love Instagram. I love social media because it gives you a chance to connect with the hobby in ways that you just can't anymore. And I think it's awesome that they have these platforms and this globalization of cards that has happened over the last couple of years, because it gives you more people to connect with.
Yeah, social media wasn't near the same back then, you know, when you started it. I mean, Facebook existed, but I'm not sure Twitter, it was in its infancy, if it had even launched in 2008, 2009, right? Correct. Like it was just getting off the ground. YouTube was very, very new in that era too, if it was even out, right? There, people weren't making video content like that. Podcasting would have been pretty brand new back in that era. You know, a lot of people didn't know what podcasting was. It was mainly, you had Facebook, you know, some there, but you also had blogs and message boards, right? Is that where you were primarily uncovering the information you were writing about? Was that coming from other blogs or message boards, or where were you able to
message
source
boards,
the content?
You know, it's a great question. Message boards were the hub of the hobby back then. You had Blowout, you had Beckett, you had a number of those areas where the hobby congregated around our water cooler. But it's changed dramatically now, obviously, because everything changes in technology. But back then it was message boards. But I also spent a ton of time talking with people. Like I talked to the people at Upper Deck, Greg Cohn at Upper Deck at the time. He's now with Leaf, but at the time he was with Upper Deck, Clay Laraski at Tops, like all of these guys who, you know, were friends of mine, right? Because I talked to them so frequently. Like I went and visited, you know, these headquarters. We had a lot of discussions. We had a lot of like opportunities at the national conventions and stuff like that to better understand how the hobby works. I got to go to things like the Rookie Premier, and I got to go to specific areas of the hobby where most collectors didn't get to go because of my site. And people wanted to have an opportunity to talk to collectors directly, because it's not like they had social media to hear it nonstop like they do today. So there was a lot of outreach to say like, hey, what did you think of this? What could we have done better? Like, I remember like I was talking with some of the Topps teams about the way that they position photos and the way that things happen. And like, I could see the influence of that feedback of that on their products, and things became more successful as they listened to more collectors and as they listened to people like me give them feedback on these things. So it was kind of a two-way street. But also, like, yeah, I read all the blogs. I kept up with all of the products that were coming out. I was in card shops. I was talking to people, you know, through my site, doing interviews, like you name it. It was a lot, and it was fun. And that was it. It was fun more than anything. My day job is not writing. My day job is not sports cards. So you can imagine, like, this took a lot of time and a lot of work. It was like a second job.
Now, that's interesting to hear you say that, because currently there's this perception that if you speak negatively about anything that these hobby companies are doing, your accessibility or your access to them and their leadership teams kind of gets cut off. But you were calling out some things that needed to be improved back then, right? But you were talking about still being invited and engaging in conversations and relationship with some of these folks at the same time that you were calling out some of the scams and shadiness going on. Did you, or would you look, you know, looking back on that, would you say there's maybe a different mindset now that these companies have compared to what they had to you know, back then? Or, you know, how do you reconcile those two things?
So I think there's, I mean, that's a tremendous point. So let me clarify something here. I don't think that there is a card company out there that just wants smoke blown up there. You know what? Like, I just don't. Constructively providing the feedback is vital to their success. And so they look to people they trust to have a good pulse of what's going on, to better understand how to improve their products. If you're coming at them and saying, this sucks, this sucks, this sucks, this sucks, you know, whatever, they're not going to listen to you. But if you can eloquently and you know, instinctively present something to them in a way that they can use and constructively adjust, they'll listen to you, especially if you prove that you have the visibility to make that criticism, you know, spread out. I remember there was a time where, you know, a product got canceled. I heard about it and posted about it. And then I immediately got a phone call from the president of that company saying that was not supposed to be posted. Why did you post that? You know, type of stuff. So obviously I had, cause it started like getting all the way through to card shops and everything like that. Back then it was such a small community. There weren't as many voices for them to reach out to. Now it's easier to cherry pick because there's so many more people that are making content. There's so many more platforms in which they can gather feedback. They don't need to have those relationships as much as they used to. And so you say, are they going to cut you off? Maybe. I mean, it kind of depends. Like, I think there are some elements of certain companies where people have thinner skins and this is their baby. This is what their personal, you know, accomplishments, their job. So like you're literally coming to somebody's job and telling them what they're doing is terrible. So that's can be offensive in a lot of ways, and they'll take it personally, even though it's really not meant to be a personal shot at them. So, I mean, like I've come to agreements. Like I was told by, like, I used to be a very vocal critic of Panini products because I thought they produced some of the worst products on the market. This was before really the change in 2015. And I was told by Panini, like, you can't attack us like this. Like, it's not fair. And I was like, well, I'm not attacking you personally. And it's like, well, you did this, this, and this. It feels very personal. And I'm just like, guys, like, you have to understand where I'm coming from. This is my personal opinion. I'm a private citizen. Like, I'm not like, and there's like, yes, but you have a platform that reaches thousands of people. Like, it, back then it was much larger of an install base. So like all of these things sort of came to be, and I get what you're saying, but it also facilitated an ongoing discussion with people. They knew that I was a vocal critic, so they wanted to see why I was criticizing them as much as I did. Now, I think products as a whole have gotten so incredibly that much better over the last probably 5 to 10 years. A lot of that criticism probably isn't as necessary because there's more budget, there's more technology, there's more ways that you can impress your consumer. Some of the things don't go as well. A lot of things do really go very well.
Yeah, I think what you said there is key. And it's the same thing that I've been told and that I've had as part of conversations with some of these company leaders, is that the constructive aspect of that criticism is the key, right? If you're just going out and blatantly bashing with no constructive feedback, that's different than trying to engage and provide legitimate feedback without personal attacks, without some of these derogatory, you know, comments. Those things can make a big difference on whether they listen to somebody providing that feedback or whether they write them off. So that constructive piece, I think, is something that's important for people to understand when they think about criticizing things that are going on in the hobby. You know, there's certain things that are, if it's a crime, if it's a true scam, if it's a true, you know, call out because of something truly underhanded going on, sure, by all means. If it is, you know, quality control issues and some other things that do or that could legitimately get improved, providing that feedback in a constructive manner, I think, goes a little bit further.
They also gave me access to understand. And I think like that's where a lot of collectors don't get that. Like, I understand why QC problems happen. I understand why autographs don't get done the way that they need to. I have a much clearer vision of why things are the way that they are because I've been told by the primary source why that is the way that it is. So I try to incorporate that into my content as much as possible, which makes the flavor of my sort of feedback very, very different. Plus, I literally have no delusions of grandeur. I know I'm like this tiny little speck on the map. So I don't have any, you know, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Like, I don't really care. Like, I don't have like this toxic masculinity where I have to be the alpha dog in the, like, I know, like, I'm some dude sitting in a chair in Minneapolis. Like, I know that that's my plight in the hobby. So I'm not like some guy that wants to be the face of anything. In fact, my face is probably better suited for radio anyways. But it's like, you know, that's kind of, you have to have that understanding is like, I'm not the most important person in the hobby. I'm one of thousands and I need to be treated like that. But if you give me access and understanding, I'm going to be able to articulate things much more clearly on why things are the way that they are. Most people just want to complain that they are without understanding and helping people understand to why that might be the case. And I think if you look at content like Sports Card News and Sports Card Radio, who have turned into a very prominent news source in the hobby, they focus on a lot of the straight news of like, this is the scam, this is what happened, whatever. But they're not really focusing as much on like, hey, this is probably why that autograph came back with an auto pen for Dak Prescott, or this is probably why these things are happening. And this is why Panini didn't catch it, or this is why Topps may not have caught it, or whatever. Those are the types of things that you need access and understanding to have. Not many people have that these days, or if they do, they're not as willing to talk about it.
You know, you've also been known to ruffle some feathers from time to time within the hobby community and the different collecting groups that are out there and the collecting bases that are out there. Is that something that you were doing later? Is that just a natural part of your personality, or is there a, you know, talk to me a little bit about how you see some of that, you know, that feather ruffling that has happened, you know, when it comes to you interacting with others in the community.
That's a very respectful way of putting it. I've always been a very opinionated individual. I mean, if you go back on my site, on my Twitter, everything is an opinion. Like, I am very opinionated, but I'm only opinionated about cards usually. Like, I really don't have a lot of feedback on like politics or finance or whatever. My areas of expertise and my lanes are clearly defined. So if somebody comes into my lane and, you know, starts to be a thorn in my side, I will give them the business that they need to understand why their takes or their sort of feedback may not be warranted. Or if it is, I'll take it. I think my favorite thing to do is to have discussions about cards. As I said at the beginning of this podcast, people when you're on social media typing and like, it doesn't, the tone always doesn't come across right. And you know, my opinions and my way of speaking tend to be very focused on an education and information delivery, opinion delivery, stuff like that, that doesn't always sit well with people. But when you have any platform, regardless if it's a podcast that you post, you know, weekly or monthly, or even, you know, infrequently, you have a blog, you have a YouTube channel. If you have a platform, you will have people come after you. Like, it's just the natural state of social media. And like, as bad as it seems like it is in certain areas of wrestling card Twitter right now, it's probably half as bad as it was, you know, when it was much smaller sort of baseball and football card communities. Like, we were at each other's throats because we all are so passionate about these cards that it becomes a very personal experience when somebody attacks you directly. And I don't like to go start fights, but I have no problem continuing and finishing them. And like, I think like that's really where the wrestling card community has become so divided, is that you have all of these people that think they are right and there is nothing that can prove that they are not right. And like, you have, but we all have very specific lanes as well. Like, I am very focused on, you know, the late Tops and Panini eras of wrestling cards. There are people who go all the way back to turn of the century, right? So we're talking, you know, 1900s to the next turn of the century, 2000s, like Tony and Paul and all those guys, they have their lane too. And then you have the vintage guys from the 80s and whatever, they have their lane. But when you start to sort of say like, oh, I've realized that this lane is becoming more of a focus because products are being released over and over and over again. The news cycle updates with that side of the business much more frequently than this, the vintage side. We went through that battle in 2002, 2003. Like this is almost 20 years or more than 20 years past that. We're going through the same thing in wrestling cards because like baseball and football and basketball, you have the separation of the vintage guys, the modern guys, the ultra modern guys, like everybody has their lane and everybody is so passionate about those lanes. They will fight to defend it. And all I can say, and this is really the key element of this, find people in this hobby that are like-minded, but are not, you know, so like-minded that they create an echo chamber. So like you have to be able to find a core group of people within your hobby space that you can rely on to trust how they engage with the hobby rather than going and trying to find, you know, a place in a populace of thousands of people. Find that small group of people, trust your friends, have fun, like all those things. If you're on social media, expect to have discussion. And I think a lot of people always want to believe that discussion is argument, and that's not always the case.
There's a couple of kind of current events topics that I wanted to get your thoughts on if you've got time for a couple more questions.
Yes, absolutely.
So first is I'd love to get your thoughts on the rise of online breaking and live selling platforms that we've seen lately, right? You know, we've got Whatnot's the kind of the big hitter you mentioned earlier. They had a rise, but also there's Loop there, you know, Fanatics Live was started. Yep. So the breaking and selling on live selling platforms are kind of the hot thing right now. I'd love to get your thoughts on those different platforms.
So I did write a recent article on my site. My feedback on this is so passionate. I wrote like 4,000 or 5,000 words on it on my website recently because I was so enthralled by this rise. It's a great question. So let's start a little bit further back because I think it's so important to this discussion. Group breaking has been a major part of the hobby for 10 plus years, going back to, 2003 or 2004 when Exquisite first hit the market in basketball and was $400 a box. No one'd seen that before. And so to be able to shoulder the burden of that cost outside of just the individual became like this need. So when National Treasures was released in 2006, 4 years later, by that point you have Chris on YouTube, Cards Infinity, you had Blowout TV going, you had all of these platforms on YouTube starting to pop up. Dr. Wax Battle, if you remember, he actually died recently, I think, from what I heard. But like all of those initial sort of informational people took on a breaking platform as well. Chris owned a card shop. You know, Blowout TV was supporting Blowout Cards. You had all these people trying to provide information in their content as well as an opportunity to reduce the individual burden of cost. Fast forward to now, those breaking platforms probably do about 50% of the business in the hobby. So it used to be, in the mid-2000s, you know, shops were responsible for probably, 45% to 65% of the product that's broken. Now it's probably even less than it's ever been because so much of the product is being broken online. And I think it just speaks to, again, the globalization of cards that has happened in this boom era. There's major issues with it. And I think you have to be very careful. And if I had more time to dedicate to my site, I would be doing a lot of articles about what's going on Facebook, especially because you have little mom and pop breakers who, you know, take in thousands and thousands of dollars of people's money. And then we've had unknowingly amount of collectors join in, and then those cards disappear or things happen. On Whatnot and on Loop and on Fanatics Live, it's much more controlled, but there's still no oversight. And now with the advent of repack products, where the breakers themselves are creating products to break with no oversight from any company, and they're running 24/7. Like literally it has become a card casino, and where you have all the flashing lights and graphics and stuff, and they're running all day, every day. You can't track everything anymore. Like it used to be Chris was only on during, you know, store hours. You know, Blowout was only on during normal working hours. These guys run all day, every day. There is always a room open, and they break their own products, which is so problematic and such a conflict of interest that I think most people don't grasp why giving these people hundreds of millions of dollars in product to break the product is such a huge challenge for people from an oversight perspective, from a scam prevention perspective. I mean, we've seen backyard breaks literally be front and center of every social media platform because they didn't give out a Trevor Lawrence kaboom that was probably worth $35,000. That's one instance of like thousands that have happened. And there's so much trust in these platforms, and it has yet to be earned. Like none of that trust is earned. And like, it's crazy to me that these platforms have become as successful as they are. Now, when you get down into like the niche breaking, like wrestling, there's very few people that are doing it at a level that we see scams happen. I'm sure they exist. I'm sure there's still huge challenges with that, but there's more trust because these people are smaller in size, but it doesn't excuse them from the same challenges that these breaking platforms have on a vast, vast, vast experience of all these different collectors. Then when you see Fanatics owning their own breaking platform, along with being invested in grading companies and card printing and auction houses and vaults, and like the monopolization of that area of the hobby will become very apparent. Come 2026, when Fanatics has all the licenses, they have all the different aspects of production and stuff, you will see a dramatic change in this platform. Whatnot and Fanatics Live will no longer be likely competitors. There will be a heavy investment in Fanatics Live, even more so than already. And the conflict of interest of a breaking platform supporting and incentivizing breakers becomes even more of a woven web of messiness that would never have happened when Chris and Dr. Wax Battle in 2004 first started on the platform.
I'm interested to see how that continues to develop. You know, I used to love buying sealed wax and opening sealed wax.
Me too.
Prior to this dopamine rush that we have, but that's pretty much completely gone away from me. And so some of these issues that people are bringing up, they don't appeal to me because I don't buy into breaks. I'm not competing for the purchase of sealed wax and the escalating cost. I don't see the value in it. And so I've not been buying it, but I'm focusing my collection on singles and vintage and that aspect of things. That's where my focus has been. So some of these issues have been less in the forefront of a direct impact to me, but you can definitely see the conflicts of interest come into play already, right? With the way that they're going after the ownership, with other content creators who are also breakers, and their whole job is to sell their breaks. So everything new is a great product, regardless of what it is, regardless of how it is. Everything's a value. Forget all of the escalating prices. It's all great. And then now once you layer on, are they going to speak bad about Fanatic, their butter, when that's who they're dependent on to get product, to be able to open, to make their livelihood? It just introduces even more of a conflict of interest. I'm interested to see how that develops. If we start to see, you know, some other shifts going on, or if that, like you said, the casino, the gambling aspect of breaking and of repack products and all of these types of things continue to kind of sustain the market, you know, in the coming years, or if we see a kind of a shift from a broader perspective.
Yeah, I think the repack products are here to stay. And there's a specific reason for that. Fanatics has cut off relationships with every distributor there is. So Peach State, Southern Hobby, Columbia, like you name it, like they no longer have the ability to sell Fanatics products. And so that means that all of those breakers who are supported by those distributors in sort of the product delivery aspect and allocations doesn't exist anymore. So they either have to buy it on the secondary market or they have to buy it directly from Topps, Fanatics, whatever you want to call them these days. And that creates like this hugely insane price competition that forces them to, you know, create their own product, buy singles on the secondary market, which they can usually get at a 60 to 70% sort of value spectrum. It becomes a much more profitable venture because the margin in product just isn't there anymore, because the Fanatics products eventually will be all of the products no longer have a relationship with the people that the breakers have a relationship with. Then if you're not breaking on Fanatics' own platform, it creates even more of a step lag in the way that you engage in the industry that way too, because now you're not on their platform. You're not with a distributor that stocks their product. How do you get revenue into your pocket if those things don't exist? The margins become razor thin. Now, if you buy a card at a raw card at 70%, then you grade it and you get a grade that makes it, you know, 3x more valuable. The margin there is insane. Like you can easily transition a smaller investment into a larger product because you've been able to staff or fund the product yourself. You're doing the boxes, the shrink wrap, the packaging, and you don't have to tell people what's in it, which is the most insane part of this whole thing. Like they just have to trust you. And none of these breakers have earned that trust. And yet people are still giving them all of this money because they're gambling's fun. Like who doesn't love gambling? So I think like that's the challenge that I think a lot of this is going to have. And I think this is the direction of the market. It's going to get more like this rather than not.
Well, hey, Adam, I really appreciate you spending some time with me today. Covered a ton of great topics. I know I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Let everybody know where they can find you if they want to follow along with your journey and if they want to start viewing some of the content that you've been creating.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter or X. I'm not going to call it X. You can find me on Twitter at SE Uncensored. And you can find me on Instagram at WWE Gelman. It's more of just a chronicle of my Becky Lynch and wrestling collection. Also, subscribe to Wrestling Trading Cards on YouTube. Great content from a number of different contributing individuals. They do a great job just sort of covering everything from, you know, vintage and, you know, just general collector experience all the way through to what we're producing around the modern and ultra modern stuff. So subscribe to Wrestling Trading Cards there. They're on Twitter as well. Just engage with the community. I love our wrestling card community. It's what made me stay. Like there's so many people here that do so many awesome things and they just do it because it's fun and they like the community. So really excited to continue to make content and be a part of this community.
Very cool. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks for having me on. This was great. I love the conversation. I do a good job. This is a lot of fun. Thank you.